It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. When COVID-19 made its way to Iowa, schools across the state were shut down in the middle of March. It quickly became clear that the state's urban areas were experiencing community spread, but in rural areas, things unfolded a little differently. Even now, with a number of rural areas becoming COVID hotspots, things feel very different in Iowa's cities versus the small towns and rural areas. This hour, we're going to talk about COVID-19 in rural Iowa, how COVID-19 has affected rural areas, and what challenges the future may hold. We also want to hear from you throughout the hour. If you live in rural Iowa, how has the pandemic affected you or not affected you? You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And my first guest this hour is Dave Peters. He's an associate professor of sociology at Iowa State University. He focuses on studying rural areas and quickly shifted his research to focus on COVID-19 in rural areas, not just in Iowa, but around the country. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here. And I tell you what, about a week ago, my family decided to go out for ice cream. And we live in Iowa City, an urban area in the state. When you go around Iowa City, of course, we're having another upswing in COVID cases, but you do see a lot of people wearing masks and taking precautions. We drove about 15 minutes away from our house to a small town, and it was like a different world. There were no masks except on us, and you know, it just feels very different to be experiencing this in rural areas.
Right. I think what you're picking up on is this false sense of rural immunity to COVID-19 in rural areas. If we look at some of the polling data nationally, at least in this region of the country, almost everyone agrees, no matter where you live in the country, that COVID-19 is being spread through community, through in-person contact. Yet around this part of the country, Minnesota, Iowa, the Dakotas, Nebraska, very few people wear masks. Only about half people say they wear masks in a store or business versus like 80% in New England, the East Coast and the West Coast, and only 23% of people in Iowa and its surrounding states say that other people in their community wear masks. So everyone recognizes that things are spreading, yet in this part of the country, particularly in rural areas, people don't wear a mask. And I think when you ask people what the impact of COVID-19 has been, they mainly talk about the economic impact, not the health impact. And so as the pandemic has yet to take hold in a lot of rural America, people see the impacts mainly from an economic side. They don't really know many people that have COVID-19. They don't know many people that have even passed away. And so it seems very abstract. And so I think people tend not to wear a mask because they haven't experienced the sizable health impacts like you have in Iowa City, or worse yet, in New York City.
Well, and I can imagine that as we closed schools and closed businesses and all of that, the sort of one-size-fits-all approach that we took to COVID-19 at the beginning of this pandemic, that has probably created some resentment and frustration in a lot of areas of rural Iowa.
Yeah, that's right. So it was the right call in New York City and other highly dense populations to shut everything down. These people in New York City live very close together. They live in very small apartments and homes. They live their lives outside of their place of residence just because it's small. And so in rural areas, that's really not practical. People have to get out and drive around to jobs. They have to get food. They can't order in for groceries. You have to be out and about to take care of your day-to-day living needs. And so I think that did create some resentment among people in rural Iowa and rural America in general, and they felt that the policies that were very proper in large cities probably weren't well suited for how rural people live.
Pretty quickly, when COVID-19 hit the country, you shifted your research. You have always been doing research about rural America, but you shifted your research to focus on COVID. Tell me what your focus has been.
Yeah, up to this point, it's been looking at rural community and social change over the last 30 years. So as farm numbers have decreased, as people have left rural communities, I'm really interested in how small towns manage to maintain services and quality of life, despite facing some sizable challenges. The other big project I've been working on the last couple of years is the rural opioid epidemic. And so a lot of the health data that I have from CDC that I've used for the opioid project lent itself very well to understanding what might be some of the risk factors for COVID-19. And, you know, again, knowing this data, I knew rural America had some risk factors, a lot of older people, larger nursing homes, more health compromised people, disease from diabetes and cardiovascular disease, for example. So I knew rural areas had some susceptibilities to begin with, even though we weren't seeing the cases. And so I developed this susceptibility scale to try to help rural communities plan ahead, to try to prepare for the pandemic before it actually took hold in their towns and communities.
Well, and let's talk about how things are different from rural area to rural area. You talked about some of the vulnerabilities that may be pretty consistent across rural areas. We do see in Iowa in particular that our rural populations do tend to be older, right?
Yep, that's right. So if we look at, so first I want to say that susceptibility, what that means is that conditions are right for an outbreak of COVID-19 to occur, but that doesn't mean that one will occur. And so the idea of the susceptibility scale is to help communities identify their specific vulnerable populations in the community before the pandemic hits. And the hope is that by taking appropriate steps and directing resources to these vulnerable at-risk populations, you can minimize the number of cases and deaths when the pandemic actually hits your town. So in Iowa's micropolitan communities, these are communities of 10 to under 50,000 people, you know, the main risk is meatpacking plants and housing and nursing facilities. And so our micropolitan communities, many of them have these large meatpacking and processing facilities we've seen outbreaks in the last several weeks from that. But they also have very large numbers of nursing homes and elderly care facilities, which have also been the locus of outbreaks in Iowa. By contrast, in our more rural communities, really what's driving risk are seniors and what we call elders, those 85 and older, diabetes risk, and of course, you know, people living in elderly care facilities and nursing care facilities. So about 55% of Iowa's rural counties show up in that highest risk category, and about 45% of our micropolitan counties show up in that high-risk category. So, yeah, rural Iowa definitely is predisposed to having outbreaks of COVID-19, and I think we've seen this at the packing plants. That's where Iowa has sort of gotten national attention in these very large outbreaks in Denison, in Loviza, Crawford County, Loviza County, Denison and Columbus Junction. That's what's really driving it in rural Iowa.
And we will talk more about those communities and those outbreaks in just a moment. But let's also talk about access to health care in rural Iowa, because, I mean, we've been doing years and years of reporting about problems of access to health care in rural Iowa, and then we get hit by a worldwide pandemic, and that becomes very scary.
Right.
Or scarier.
Scarier, yeah. Definitely on the health care issue. Rural areas nationally and in Iowa, the rate of uninsured is higher than in metro counties. So that means that people delay going to the doctor because they don't have adequate health insurance. So that's a problem. Then when they do access health care, underinvestment in the rural health care infrastructure has meant that, you know, at most, if you have a hospital in nearby, and that's usually what we call a critical access hospital, it's a federal designation, that's 25 or fewer beds, 35 or more miles away from another hospital, they offer good services, but it's very limited services. And so the ability to access specialists related to the pandemic is not going to be available in most rural hospitals. And so that's an issue. Secondly, some communities don't even have a hospital. They have a rural health care clinic that sometimes isn't even staffed by a physician, more likely a physician's assistant. And so if you have a serious complication from COVID-19, the ability of rural healthcare centers and hospitals to treat you effectively is minimized. And again, it's time, so you might have to be transferred to a larger hospital, but all that takes time and distance. And lack of health insurance means people avoid going to seeing the doctor, and once they do see the doctor, there's the risk of financial, you know, financial collapse of that household if they're unable to pay medical bills.
Early in the pandemic, as we talked about, we really saw this divide between how COVID-19 was spreading in urban areas and spreading in rural areas. We are seeing more rural spread now. And of course, a lot of the people who live in urban areas in Iowa come from these rural areas in Iowa originally. Right. So what do we know about people passing back and forth through these urban areas and the rural areas and possibly carrying disease?
Yeah, I think that is a very real danger. I mean, we don't have very good data to say anything for certain, but, you know, anecdotally and just logic would dictate that, yeah, I mean, a lot of people leave their communities in rural Iowa and go to work in larger cities. And when the pandemic hits, they want to go back, one, just for safety. You know, they feel safer in their small communities, but they also go back to care for older parents or other relatives. And so, yeah, there is a risk of former residents going back home, you know, bringing the virus back into the community where they were from in Des Moines or Minneapolis or Omaha. So, yeah, I think that there is a lot of that, happening. And of course, if they go back to take care of their parents, particularly if they're older or someone that has a health condition, and then it becomes particularly dangerous because those groups are much more likely to become infected with COVID-19 and pass away. In fact, that if we look at the data for Iowa, that what is it here? But yeah, there are 12 times people with health issues are 12 times more likely to die from COVID-19 than those without. And so, yeah, having this really becomes having a health issue really complicates your prognosis.
And we'll talk more about that in just a moment. You are listening to Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about COVID-19 in rural Iowa. There has been a real difference between how COVID-19 has progressed and played out in the urban areas of the state and in the rural areas of the state. It may feel like COVID-19 isn't coming to rural Iowa, but rural Iowa has a unique set of challenges and vulnerabilities. Dave Peters has been studying those challenges and vulnerabilities. He's an associate professor of sociology at Iowa State University. And I want to share, Dave, before we bring on our next guest, I want to share this email. This is from the Dearth family. A tale of two 2020 high school seniors, cousins, both from Iowa, one rural, one urban. Rural senior threw a grad party, both inside and outside, served food. Urban senior decided not to throw a party due to too many guests in high-risk categories. Rural senior cousin gets to keep their job at the pool, teach swim lessons. Pool was open today for public swimming. Urban cousin, city pool was closed, would not be working at the pool this summer and had to look for a different job. I mean, that sums up a lot of the differences so far. But in talking about these vulnerabilities of rural areas, do you feel like it's inevitable that COVID will reach into all of these rural areas?
Yeah, I do. Now, they're low population communities, and so it's not going to generate a lot of cases, but as a percent or a share of the population, yeah, I think it will. You see states recently in the South, Texas, Arizona, Florida, notably, that really early on ended their closure orders, and very quickly we saw a rebound of cases. And I think when cases do finally spread to rural counties that are more remote, and people continue to engage without masks and without some sensible social distancing rules, yeah, I think there will be a steep rise in cases. In fact, if you look at the hotspots, the top 25 or 30 top COVID-19 hotspots in the country, the majority of them are in rural areas. We only see a few in Iowa, and they're mainly associated with packing towns and communities with nursing homes. That's where the outbreaks are. But outside of Iowa, a lot of these rural counties, you know, don't have any of those usual suspects like a packing plant or nursing home. It's just transmission within the community. So I think that will, we're only a state of 3 million. We're a pretty dispersed population. So I think over time, and particularly if a second wave hits, if people aren't used to social distancing and they haven't developed those norms of wearing a mask out in public, I think that there's a danger of COVID becoming a major issue in some communities in rural Iowa.
We have seen some of Iowa's tourist communities begin to experience a significant number of cases in the Iowa Great Lakes region up by Okoboji, mm-hmm. Clear Lake, another place where a lot of people flock during the summer months. So the summer has changed some of the dynamics as well.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to your earlier your point that COVID-19 is being brought into rural communities. So who goes and vacations in the Great Lakes area or up in Clear Lake, Iowa, or up, you know, further north in Minnesota, people from cities. And so as tourists from larger communities that have been more exposed to the virus because of their population densities, as they vacation in these smaller communities, yeah, it brings it in. I know in northern Minnesota, there's a number of communities that have put out ads in newspapers in the Twin Cities asking residents in the Twin Cities not to come up to their community because their small rural hospital can handle for the resident population, but if, you know, doubling or tripling the size of the population with summer tourists, their local healthcare system is not able or not prepared to handle that. So there is a danger, particularly in these areas with natural amenities, lakes and other tourist attractions. There's a risk that could overwhelm local healthcare as people from cities vacation in those areas.
I want to bring Nicole Novak into the conversation. She is an assistant research scientist in community and behavioral health at the University of Iowa. She's been working with Dave Peterson on his research. And Nicole, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah.
Nicole, I want to focus now on an area of research that you've been particularly focused on, which are those rural areas with meatpacking plants. And of course, if anybody's been following the news, and I hope you have, you know, people know that these meat processing plants are places where COVID has spread very quickly. It's very difficult to social distance within these plants. It took a while for the plant operators to recognize that COVID was actually in the plant and get tests and do testing and take some precautions. And there are so many issues involved in this. But why don't you give us a little bit of a rundown of what makes these communities with meat processing plants so vulnerable to COVID?
Yeah. Well, I think Professor Peters has just set this up really well, thinking about all the ways that rural communities are really diverse, right? They're not all the same, and they have different vulnerabilities and susceptibilities. In terms of communities that have meatpacking plants, there's a few things. Most of Iowa's meatpacking communities are what we call micropolitan communities. So they're these mid-sized rural communities that have tended on average to have a harder time economically, for example, since the Great Recession over the last 10 years, and are sometimes just facing other challenges that affect public health for the whole community. So something we often see in public health is that communities that face economic challenges or challenges with social inequality see those things reflected in public health. So communities that have more poverty are going to have higher rates of mortality, higher rates of chronic disease. And as Professor Peter mentioned, those are things that we know make people also vulnerable to COVID. And then, you know, the other thing with meatpacking plants is the conditions within the workplace, and then also the fact that workers are not only affected by their workplace, they carpool with other people to get to work. They live at home with other people, sometimes in multi-generational households. And so even if there is higher risk of transmission within the workplace, it ends up putting the whole community at risk because people go home and take that risk with them to other folks they're connected to.
Well, and Dave, as you were saying a few minutes ago, a lot of these micropolitan communities, they may have meat processing plants, but they're also the places where we have more nursing home facilities and things like that, and possibly prisons and daycares and all of those things. And
yes.
I mean, Dave, I've got to believe that a similar population also works at these places.
Yeah, I think what Nicole had mentioned, is, and Charity, you're right as well, these micropolitans really serve as regional trade and service centers for a larger group of rural counties. And so if you live in a rural county, if you go to the hospital, you're getting health care, you're going to a micropolitan. If you're shopping for big ticket items, you're going to a micropolitan. Most people in rural counties work, commute in to work to micropolitans. And so the risk of spread back to rural areas, as even if they don't work in the meatpacking plant, the workers that do work in the plant go to the grocery store. A lot of rural communities don't have grocery stores. You have to go to a micropolitan to visit the grocery store. You're coming in contact and you're bringing that back into the community. We've also seen, particularly in eastern Iowa and Washington County, just south of Iowa City, that we do see that there are people that work in the meatpacking plants but don't necessarily live in the community. They move to rural areas because housing is less expensive or they prefer a quality of life. And so, you know, the impact of the packing plant extends beyond just the boundaries of the community. It spreads out to, you know, the surrounding rural counties as people commute in to that job. And so there's a lot of movement, there's a lot of commuting in rural areas because of lack of jobs locally, lack of services and retail locally.
And of course, as we've talked about already, there are social elements to this as well. It's not just about health. It's about how people are feeling about what's happening and how they may be treating each other. And I'm curious, either Dave or Nicole, when you're looking at how this virus is moving through these communities, are we also looking at some of the social problems that come along with it? Perhaps a discrimination against people who might be working in meatpacking plants because now they have an additional stigma of possibly carrying this virus. Dave, you want to respond to that first?
Sure. I think you're absolutely right. In not all, but many meatpacking towns, they're mainly minority residents, mostly Latino, though not exclusively. You know, this is a segment of that community that perhaps wasn't felt as welcome. They maybe see them as short-term residents. They're not well integrated into the community. They may not have deep ties, and so they rely mainly on themselves or their family. And so in many towns, meatpacking towns, the meatpacking workers are sort of seen as separate from the rest of the community. They may not be involved in decision-making. Local health care and public health efforts might not include them directly in planning efforts, or there might not be a lot of outreach. And so, I think that just would exacerbate their already marginalization from social life in these communities. You know, add to the fact that, you know, meatpacking work, it's strenuous, it's hard work. I mean, it's a hard job. I'm not sure what the benefit packages are, but not everyone might have health insurance that works in those plants. That would just add on to other burdens that packing workers face, both whether the minority or non-minority.
Well, and Nicole, speaking of how diverse these communities are, I think from a distance, a lot of people like to kind of lump together, okay, it's Latinx Iowans working in these meatpacking plants, or it's refugee populations. But there's a huge mix of people who are working in these plants, right?
Yeah, absolutely. People have called them micro pluralities or kind of hyper diverse communities. So what I've heard from the League of United Latin American Citizens, which is a Latino civil rights group in Iowa, they say about half of the meatpacking workforce is Latino in Iowa, and the rest includes U.S.-born workers as well as refugees and immigrants from all over the world. So Atumwa is a community that I'm really familiar with. They have a pork processing plant there owned by a company called JBS. And the reported number of languages spoken in that plant is 32 languages. So we're not just talking about English and Spanish, but also Burmese, Marshallese, Vietnamese, Amharic, Somali, French. The list goes on. And I think that really reflects, you know, the challenges for local public health departments, as well as the challenges for the workers themselves to be integrated and welcomed into the community, to get access to the resources they need. And then most recently, access to trusted information about COVID and how to mitigate their own risk. We already know in public health that in times of crisis, there is a lot of mistrust, a lot of risk of kind of rumors or people being afraid of the, or having trouble accessing information. And we definitely saw that for a lot of immigrant and refugee communities throughout Iowa, and especially meatpacking communities. I also wanted to add on your point about discrimination in rural communities, and that's always been an issue for rural meatpacking communities, issues with racism and just segregation, social division. And most recently, LULAC did report a few cases of people being refused service because of stigma, thinking that Latino workers in these rural towns were more likely to be carrying COVID. So that's been reported nationwide, but also specifically in Marshalltown. Someone reported being refused entry to, I believe, a grocery store.
Oh, wow. Let's look ahead a little bit as well. I know that we've got plenty of issues to deal with right now in this moment, but let's also look ahead to August when school starts again. Right now, of course, schools are working really hard to come up with their return to learn plans. We have a little bit more idea of what our university return to learn plans are going to look like. But no matter how you cut it, it looks like people are going to be coming into contact with each other much more. And I suspect return to learn plans are going to look pretty different in a lot of rural areas than they do in the urban areas of Iowa. Dave, have you looked ahead to how returning to school may play into how COVID affects rural Iowa?
Yeah, I think one is this digital divide that people have talked about since the 90s really is showing why it matters. I mean, when people talk about the digital divide, they say, well, okay, you can't stream your shows, or you can't, it's not as easy to shop on Amazon online. But when a pandemic like this happens and people can't go to school or people can't go to the healthcare system that has to be done remotely, then the ability of teleeducation or telehealth services in rural communities is limited, because a lot of rural communities lack broadband access and a lot of rural households don't have a broadband subscription. So even if you bring access to the community, there's a large number of households, mainly obviously low to moderate income ones, that just can't afford a subscription to high-speed internet. So ways to simply, you know, the common response, particularly from urban-based policies, is, well, we'll just rely on the internet to deliver education and healthcare. And while that might work in larger cities, in rural communities, the lack of infrastructure and the limited income ability of many rural households to get access to that internet, that high-speed internet, is limited. And so that's going to be an issue in how you address that. If you're not going to let kids back in the schools, you're not doing some sort of rotation of days, and you're relying solely on the internet to provide instruction, there is a huge possibility of a group of students, mainly low to moderate income students, of being left behind. And there's equity issues on that.
Well, and we also know that we're in the midst already of a child care crisis. And if children aren't in schools, that just gets compounded, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, rural child care is one of the big issues facing many communities in the state. Hopefully, daycare providers will remain open. Hopefully a lot of them didn't decide to just stop doing that. But you're going to have the demand for child care will far surpass the available capacity in rural areas. And so that's an issue of people getting back to work, parents getting back to work, reestablishing themselves financially. It's going to hit rural communities harder because of the lack of available child care options.
We have this note from Laura really underlining a point that you made earlier, Dave. She says, I just want to make a point that it's not just with COVID. I live in a small town in southeast Iowa. We don't have a doctor. We lost mental health care. And with isolation because of COVID, we need mental health care back now more than ever. And so, again, we were already experiencing a health care crisis in rural Iowa. This is compounding it.
Yeah, I think, Jerry, I mean, what the listener said was absolutely correct. We haven't really hit on that, but, you know, Iowa's done a fairly good job at addressing the immediate health crisis as a state and most communities have. But what we haven't addressed and we is the mental health, the emotional toll it'll take for the recovery. And most states, and Iowa's no exception, has underinvested in mental health services. And there's really a lack of that in rural communities. And that's critical for communities, whether they're urban or rural, to recover from the pandemic, is getting people back on their feet emotionally and dealing with the emotional distress and toll of losing jobs, losing loved ones.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me, Dave Peters of Iowa State University, Nicole Novak of the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about COVID-19 in rural Iowa. Rural Iowa has its own special set of challenges and vulnerabilities. And yet, at the same time, there are places in Iowa where it doesn't feel like COVID-19 has reached it yet, or maybe will ever reach it. It's a very different experience to be in many places in rural Iowa than to be into some of the urban areas or hotspots in the state. We'd love to hear about your experiences, your thoughts. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With us this hour, Dave Peters, an associate professor of sociology at Iowa State University. He's been researching those vulnerabilities in rural areas all around the country. Nicole Novak is an assistant research scientist in community and behavioral health at the University of Iowa, and she's been working with Dave Peters on his research and also focusing on how meat processing plants are in some of the places in Iowa and around the country that are most vulnerable to COVID-19. I want to bring Alejandro Ortiz into the conversation now. He's a community organizer based in Des Moines, but he's been traveling around the state. Hello, Alejandro.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here. And Alejandro, I know that you are originally from Woodbury County. I know that you're based in Des Moines now, but tell me a little bit about the work that you've been doing traveling around the state and focusing on some of these very vulnerable populations.
Right. And thank you for having me on the show. A little bit about, just in terms of the, in particular, the meatpacking plants. I mean, this is an industry that has truly been a part of my entire life. Growing up in Sioux City, Iowa, that's where I was born and raised. Both my parents continue to this day to work in the, meatpacking plant industry. And truly that does extend to my extended family, cousins, aunts, uncles, that work in this industry and have done so since before I was born. So really, when we really started to truly understand a lot more, what COVID-19 was like, how it spread. We were having those conversations, myself, my siblings, my cousins, my childhood friends were having conversations with our parents about, not only how to protect them, yourself, but also, what's your company doing for you? And we really started to hear some pretty scary things, especially given how much uncertainty, there continues to be around this virus. And so, as many of us were kind of, to some extent, screaming into the void. We weren't sure if anyone was going to pay attention or really even care that, we weren't really getting much response from these plants. But, we were able to create a Facebook community, a Facebook group that has almost 1,000 people at this point, of just people mainly out in the Woodbury County area, and kind of off, even some folks out in Nebraska, in that tri-state area as well, of just people that family members, some workers, and just that community that really wanted to pay attention and do what we can to help out these workers and provide any resources that we know there's always been gaps in. So that's really how that developed and, was able to make contact with workers all across the state and really identify where they were and what was going on in their plant, and while it was pretty tough, every day something, we were getting new updates, and that was the same in each plant. These plants were functioning in different timelines in terms of the spread, but we were really getting a good idea of why there was so much confusion, why there was so much fear in a lot of these plants.
Well, and you talked about trying to talk to your family members who are working in these plants. Did you get any resistance from them? I mean, individuals could take precautions or start wearing a mask on their own before the company called for that. Were workers receptive to that idea?
I would say that, you know, that was, you know, the, you know, kind of dependent, as was spoken to earlier. There's, you know, a decent amount, and this is widespread throughout the, you know, the I guess, the planet, really, is that, you know, false information can be spread about, you know, just how serious of a pandemic it really is, and all of that was definitely an obstacle that we continue to face. However, I would say, you know, in terms of, you know, my family, those that I was speaking to, those that were truly, you know, had some level of fear in what was going on, you know, were doing what they could outside of work to protect themselves and, you know, had the option, of course, to bring masks. I did get some hesitance from workers and even from my own parents as to, like, well, we want the company to make these changes. We want the company to step up and provide the masks, to step up and provide the sanitizers and everything that's going to be needed. And there was some hesitance in you know, bringing in, and I mean, it was at that point a little tough to find a mask.
Sure. And, yes. You know, well, and there was mixed messaging, of course, even from exactly. the CDC about whether or not mask wearing was a good idea. I want to ask you, we know that the Latino population in Iowa has been hit so much harder by COVID than other parts of our population. And I only have statistics from April, and I assume that this trend has continued, but I'd love to get an update. But we know that about 6% of the general population in Iowa is Latino, and 23.5% of positive COVID tests in April were among the Latino population. And we also know, especially in rural Iowa, there are a lot of people who don't know anybody who's had COVID-19. It's one of those things that makes the disease feel unreal. But I suspect that's very different in the Latino population in the state. Maybe you can give me a little personal insight. How many people do you know personally who've had COVID-19?
I don't even know if I have a specific number I can, you know, cling to and tell you. I would say roughly 10. You know, and much of this plays into the fact that, as I mentioned, my extended family, I have cousins, aunts, uncles, who work in the industry, that work in, say, like the large plants, say Tyson. Again, both my parents work there, and, you know, they live with my sister and with my brother-in-law. My cousins, they have their own families, they have their children. So, you know, a cousin that maybe got the virus, you know, then their spouse, their children got the virus. Likewise, in the household of, you know, where luckily my dad was isolating somewhere else, you know, if he would have gotten the virus, you know, that would have just, that I don't know how well he would have responded to it. So when we discovered that, you know, my mom at the time was out of work, not all of the plants, but some plants were, you know, we're willing to allow at-risk workers to take some time off. You know, anyone over 60 or potentially workers, you know, who have pre-existing conditions to, you know, to this day, I don't believe Tyson has done that, but other companies like Smithfield have taken those types of precautions. So she was able to stay out of work, but she was living with my brother-in-law who, you know, works at one of the other plants. Mm-hmm. And when he contracted the virus, I mean, at that point, he brought it home. And, you know, so my sister, my mother, and, you know, likely their baby as well had the virus. So it's really, you know, it's, you know, there was some statistics earlier that, you know, 1 in 4 Latinos know somebody. But I mean, just in these communities, talking to, you know, again, my friends growing up, you know, we, large parts of our families were being affected. Four of us that really started to do some of this advocacy work early on, we started doing this before anyone we knew had it. And by the end of it, all four of us had immediate family members, and three of us had our parents who, you know, at least one of our parents who had contracted the virus. So it was, you know, pretty widespread in terms of, you know, that community, you know, throughout the state.
Right. Very real and very present. Alejandro, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for letting me on your show.
Alejandro Ortiz is a community organizer based in Des Moines. He's been traveling around the state. And I want to bring somebody else into the conversation now, too, before we run out of time, because as Alejandro was saying, it feels very present in many communities. In other places, not so much. Shauna Ramirez is co-owner of Tequila's Mexican Bar and Grill in Northwood, Iowa. That's in Worth County. Northwood has a population of around 2,000 people. It's the county seat of Worth County, way up in north central Iowa. The entire county has a population of less than 8,000 people, and there have been 14 cases of COVID-19 in the county so far. Hello, Shauna.
Hi there.
Thank you so much for talking with me today. And being the owner of a restaurant in a rural area, that puts you in the COVID hotspot, even if you're not exposed to cases. How has this affected your business?
We're kind of an exception to a lot of cases from what I've heard, because we have our community is really supportive. And we actually, for the 9 weeks or so that we were had to be, closed for dine-in, we did an amazing, tremendous amount of carry-out. So that was kind of, it didn't affect us to the point of that, like we thought, because, initially it was scary and we were like, what's going to happen? So it's actually been, it hasn't been as bad as you would think for us, because we had a lot of community support, so.
That's great to hear. Do you feel like people in your community take COVID-19 seriously?
I think it's a mix. There are some that I can tell don't, think it's a real thing. But there are some. There's plenty that do take it seriously. There's a lot of masks being worn. But then again, it's like a mix. It's like really completely down, it's like down the center line pretty much.
Well, and do you feel like that's a political decision for a lot of people as opposed to a personal health decision?
That's kind of a thing around here too. It all became pretty political, I think. And, I just, as a business owner in a small town, I just try to stay, as neutral as I can.
Well, do you feel like you're able to do what you need to do to keep you and the employees at the restaurant safe?
We've taken some extra precautions. A lot more sanitizing going on. You can't obviously have placements on the tables. Although, everywhere I go is so different. I've seen it all at this point, because we've been dining out also. I've seen everything, you're not supposed to do this or do that. And everywhere is kind of different. I feel like it's just there's so many gray areas at this point. It's just you don't even know what to expect. So.
Yeah. Well, and as I said before, in a place like Northwood, it can feel like COVID-19 is very far away. Is it hard sometimes for you to take precautions and, feel like you're at risk, given that it doesn't feel dangerous at the moment?
Kind of in the beginning, I feel like it was kind of like that, because it was like, well, actually, no, I take that back. In the beginning, it was kind of, it was super real, because it was such a big thing. And we were like, oh my gosh, we have to, everything was just changing and whatever. But then after a little while, when everything just stayed kind of stable in this county, it was kind of like, it almost made you feel like everything happened too soon for certain areas. Maybe people wouldn't have become so, I don't know the word I'm looking for. They wouldn't have become so, it seems like everyone just got kind of bored with it. And then everyone was just ready to, to a little too soon now, because now I do know that I know specifically of people that I know that have had it or have it or, currently. So
right.
It's becoming more real again. So it's I don't know.
Quarantine fatigue happened everywhere, but I can't imagine that in rural Iowa it was more acute, feeling like you made sacrifices maybe when you didn't need to.
Yes, because for the longest time we sat at zero cases. We were one of the counties that had nothing. And then, you know, then it was like 2 or 3 and now it's 14 or whatever, you know, and it's, you know, it, I mean, that's still a relatively low number compared to like a lot of places, but you know, it's still when you start to know people that, you know, have been in contact or have been tested or have it, then it becomes a lot more real, I guess.
Yeah. Shauna, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. Shauna Ramirez is co-owner of Tequila's Mexican Bar and Grill in Northwood, Iowa, up in Worth County. And we have just a couple of minutes left. Dave and Nicole, I'd love to hear from you as we go here. What are you most concerned about in the next few weeks or even months when you look at rural Iowa? Dave?
Yeah, I think what, you know, Shauna was mentioning, just this fatigue that I think she said it really well, that, you know, people did what they were supposed to do early on. The surge didn't happen. And so people, I worry, are not going to comply with social distancing and wearing masks and other practices when it really matters the most. You know, right when the pandemic's likely to hit rural areas, people have already sort of fatigued out or got tired of following those rules. So it's just a bad aligning of events that could make for, you know, pretty sizable outbreaks in rural communities. So yeah, I think that that's my biggest concern, and the lack of mental health in the recovery.
I have an email from Maureen, and she says that living in a small town in northeast Iowa, she says that the feelings here regarding the pandemic are it isn't happening here, it's out there. Some people wear masks, but it was more in the early days than now. And she says one thing not mentioned in your program is the political spin that has unfortunately been given to wearing a mask. As our area is Trump country and staunchly conservative, wearing a mask says you are a believer, and not wearing a mask says you are not. And
well,
we have just a minute left.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah. I'll let Nicole speak. Yeah.
Okay, Nicole, do you want to respond to that or give Dave a chance to talk about the political implications very briefly?
I think I would just want to say that when I look ahead for Iowa, the thing I just always want to watch for is the communities that are most vulnerable. So those who are non-citizens, those who face barriers to health care. And what we see over and over again in these public health crises is that when we kind of fall through, when we're not protecting our communities, those are often the folks who suffer the most. So I just want to make sure that we continue to watch out for the folks who have them, who are up against the most barriers.
Absolutely. Nicole Novak, thank you so much for talking with us today. Assistant Research Scientist in Community and Behavioral Health at the University of Iowa. Dave Peters, thank you very much.
You bet. Happy to be on the show.
Dave Peters, Associate Professor of Sociology at Iowa State University. We've been talking about COVID-19 in rural Iowa, something that unfortunately we'll probably have an opportunity to revisit in the coming months as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.